Hello, I'm Karen Florin, and this is the Storyline Podcast. Today, I'm with Judge Hillary Strackbine, who has been a Superior Court judge in Connecticut for the past 18 years. Judge Strackbine is the head administrative judge in the New London Judicial District. Welcome to the show, Judge, and I wonder if you can tell us what are some of the duties of an administrative judge.
All right, thanks for having me today. Right, and there's different levels. There's the administrative judge in a district, first of all, has certain duties that are different from in court. So the administrative judge, based on the title, does some administrative things. For example, we assign the judges within the district as to what they'll be doing. Some people do criminal, some people do family, some people do civil, some people do juvenile. And if one of them is not available, I'm able to reassign those judges or cover myself if there is no one to do that. I have to, you know, I keep informed on any judicial policies. I'm supposed to oversee the activities of the marshals. And part of my job really is to reinforce public perception, get involved with jury when the jurors come in and set up when trials will happen and where those trials will happen. That's the basic duties. And, of course, my regular job of Part A presiding judge.
So you are sort of the boss of the judges in the district, as well as overseeing the judicial marshals who are in charge of the facilities and security. And not only that, but you are in charge of the major crimes court, basically, is what Part A means. I wonder if we can move on. We can talk about what's happening in the New London courts at this stage in the pandemic.
As you know, during the pandemic, we combined courts because we closed certain courts and combined certain courts. For some time, Huntington Street, which is the Part A court, as you know from being there all the time, we then had GA10, GA21, and GA11. And we tried to do all of those courts during the pandemic. It worked out, but as you know, that would normally cause a backlog. However, since we've reopened, I can tell you things are going exceptionally well. In GA10, with Sherry Murphy, and now with the new judge, Judge O'Hanlon, there is no case from the pandemic that has not been heard. She has arranged and had every single case, unless the rearrest, people who aren't, we can't get, but every single case has been heard and has a schedule. So she has very diligently worked on the backlog, and we don't want a backlog.
Judges Murphy and O'Hanlon are sitting at GA10, which is the, we call it the lower level.
It's the Part B court. Some people have called it the brown court, and I'm the white court. And I didn't know what that meant, but our building is white, and their building is brown.
So this is the courthouse up on Broad Street in New London.
Yes.
And you, of course, are in the, you know, the historic courthouse on White Courthouse on Huntington Street. GA21 is the courthouse in Norwich.
Yes.
And then 11 is Danielson?
That's Danielson, and we also have the juvenile court in Waterford. Currently, there's about 4,200 cases pending in the GA, in GA10, 2,900 motor vehicle cases. And in Part A, my court, there's about 200 cases. And Norwich has about 4,600 cases, and they also have infractions. There's always a lot of cases. The civil court, which is also in Huntington Street, has around 3,300 pending cases, 884 of which are on the trial list. There's five cases that have gone to verdict since we opened. In civil, and they've settled several jury cases. Since we're allowed to have jury trials now when people are told they can have a jury, now it's moving business because not everyone wants a jury, but we like to be able to provide a trial if possible, and now we can.
Sometimes just getting a jury selection date helps to resolve a case.
Quite often, that's the case. Like before, the problem was without a threat of a trial, people delayed things, and I understand that. In our court, I mean, we have over 20 murders. We have a trial list of those murders, and as people know, murder cases take quite some time because it requires more jurors. A non-murder needs 6 jurors with 2 alternates, but a murder case is 12 and usually plus 4. So you need 16 jurors in a murder case. And right now I have 11 murder cases on the trial list and currently 1 trial judge. So it takes time, which is basically unrelated to the pandemic. Now that we can have jury trials, some of those may settle, but murders are notoriously difficult to settle.
So, Judge, we often get questions from our audience about why it takes so long for cases to move through the court system. And having sat and watched for 15 years, I completely understand all the mechanisms and all the, you know, complexities that have to take part. But could you sort of walk through, let's say, a criminal case from arrest to sentencing, some of the things that take place?
Right. Cases start usually with a warrant, which is start an arrest, or what we call an on-site, which means the police are brought to a scene at the time the crime is happening. The first thing that happens is an arraignment. So the defendants come in and they get assigned a lawyer, or they have a lawyer, or they get a public defender. That starts the process of moving the case along.
Okay, question.
Right.
A lot of times a new reporter will be very carefully watching for that first not guilty plea.
Right.
But really, everybody's pleading not guilty.
It's actually what we would call pro forma. Like, everyone enters not guilty plea with a jury election. That's like what the words that are said. All that does, though, it moves a case to the next level. The next level are pretrials. And that starts the longer part of what people can see as delays. And there's many reasons for that. Each case is unique and has different needs. Often, the public defender or defense lawyer, they have certain responsibilities they need to do before they can get a plea. For example, psychological evaluations. There is a lot of mental health issues with these defendants. Quite often, that's a problem. So a psychological evaluation takes time. They have to get the right psychologist. That psychologist has to meet with the defendant and write a report. Now you're looking at maybe 2 to 3 months for that to happen, sometimes longer. There's also the competency problem. Some people are not competent, or we need to find out if they're competent. So there's a name for that. The competency evaluation is called a 5456D. That can cause a delay because they have to be evaluated for competency. And if someone's found not competent, that extends the case even longer while they try to get them back to competent so that they can stand trial. That causes a delay. Drug addiction, one of our biggest problems, can cause a delay because people will need a program, which we try to provide. A long-term program takes time. They're not long enough. But 6 to 8 months in a program before you would actually resolve a case also takes time. So then there's the people who want trials. And there's, you know, we have a trial list, and that takes time. So when people wonder, what's taking so long? Well, someone could have a psychological evaluation, a competency evaluation, not to mention the investigation by their lawyer of the case itself. That's what causes the delays, even in resolving a case. And the trial, wanting a trial, which everyone's entitled to, gets onto a list, and that takes time. And we only have, you know, limited trial judges. So there's only so much a trial judge can do. They usually, obviously, can do 1 trial at a time.
So do you keep track of how many court appearances a defendant makes on average? Do you have any sense of how many times they'll appear in court for a major charge before their case is resolved?
If they're not going to trial, but a plea, before I forget, and after they plead, there's a pre-sentence investigation done by probation, and now that's 10 more weeks, even after they plead. So we're used to that, this long process. But I would say on the average, at Part A, which is what I do, these are like rapes, murders, robberies, the most serious cases. I'd have to say there's probably 10 appearances before a case would actually go to plea based on discovery, you know, investigation, and any other testing that needs to be done, because a defense lawyer has that obligation to make sure their client knows what they're doing if they're going to plead.
Another frequent misperception is that defendants don't deserve a plea offer from the state, but just about everybody gets a plea offer. Will you explain that?
Okay. When we continue a case after someone pleads not guilty, every case has a pretrial. A pretrial is where the state will make an offer. Every defendant gets an offer. Every defendant deserves an offer. Now, there's some cases that the defendant doesn't want an offer. Those are cases they don't have to take an offer. Obviously, they're entitled to a trial. A lot of cases do settle without a trial. And there's a certain negotiation that goes into that. And since COVID, we have tried to resolve cases that were lingering. And we kind of call it like a COVID discount, because if someone's been staying out of trouble during the pendency of the pandemic, I take that into consideration. It's important if someone has somehow in this terrible time been able to not have dirty urines, not pick up new charges. It's almost as if they've been on probation during a time when all of us have been suffering, and many of us who hopefully don't have mental health issues. These are people with mental health or addiction problems. So everyone gets an offer, and we try to make these offers fair, and also to meet the obligations the state has of accountability for the behavior of the defendant.
And I know that you have some very skilled victim advocates that work for the judicial branch. Can you explain how they are involved in the process on behalf of the victims?
You know, I at the risk of hyperbole, our victims advocates are exceptional. There's two of them at Part A. That one is Leanne Verdefay and one is Stephanie Barber. I don't even know how we ever functioned without them. They are involved in every aspect of the process, and so that means victims have a voice. And the victims have a strong voice. The victims' advocates are they come to pretrials. They give the court and the state and the defense the victim's position, whether how damaged these victims are. Some victims are physically hurt. Some are mentally hurt. Some have been raped. And often victims are actually family members of people who've been murdered. It's a very difficult job. And these two women actually make my job much easier. I need to know the positions of victims, because I'm very victim oriented, and I think our society needs judges and all the people involved to take victims very seriously. We have a significant amount of domestic violence cases, especially during the pandemic, and those cases are very serious, and we try to the victims' advocates really help us with all of these cases, but especially domestic violence cases.
Yeah, having covered courts for so long, a frequent complaint that I would hear from survivors and victims was that the defendant or the person accused of the crime had all the rights, and that really is not true. Victims also have rights. That are, as you said, they are carefully voiced.
Absolutely. The victims have a strong voice. I know people think that only the defendants have, and defendants, of course, have rights, and they're the ones whose liberty is at stake, and so we take, of course, their rights very seriously. But victims, if we don't address the victim situation appropriately, the victims would have very long-term consequences of what's happened to them. And so to have their voice always heard, they're heard in court personally and with the victim's advocate. I would say their rights are very much protected, which I consider extremely important.
So there are so many nuances that we could be discussing, Judge, and maybe you'll come back another time and we can take up another topic. But before we conclude, I wonder, is there anything that you would like to say that the public really should know about the court system?
Well, I guess I would say the courts are open. People are welcome to come to court. They may have to wear masks. We're still working on the mask situation, but the courts are open and we're here to address all the issues that come up. The public is welcome to come in, and I think the public needs to know that at least, you know, I think throughout the state and my colleagues, we really care about moving the cases along and having fair dispositions of matters, taking both the defendant and the victims into account.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.